is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I want to thank you for joining us for another live edition of Midrats. And this just isn't any Midrats. We are going to kind of do a little bit of self-congratulatory preening. It'll be a little bit, but this is our 10th anniversary Midrats. And today we're going to probably spend the first half of the hour, just because we have been doing this for 10 years, just do a little bit of perspective about what we've seen in the last 10 years and maybe talk about the medium a little bit and bring on one of our surprise guests who's kind of an important part of the show. And the second half of the show, we'll focus in on some of the news of the day. As my illustrious co-host pointed out to me in our pre-show chitter-chat, that I should probably tell everybody that, because if people don't care what we did the last 10 years and might want to hear some discussion about some of the breaking news, that you wouldn't lose interest. So come back for the second half of the hour if you don't care about what we've done the last 10 years. And I think it'd also be remiss if we didn't mention that for those that don't know, when we started, we had another co-host, a guy who, like my co-host and I, were kind of the early adopters in the ecosystem on the Navy military security blog type thing. It's now crowded, and that's a good thing. And that's Raymond Pritchard, who had a blog called Information Dissemination, also went by Galarin for a while. But he was with us for the first part of the show, before life called him to do other things. So Raymond, if you're out there, we appreciate you. You are an important part of giving us the peer pressure to move forward. And also peer pressure, I don't think I would still be doing this if I didn't have my great co-host. I call him Ever Genial, because not just with Midrats here and online, but if you ever had the pleasure of meeting my co-host in person, he is indeed very genial Southern gentleman, by adopted Southern. But Eagle One, great to have you on board, and thanks for the last 10 years.
Oh, no, Sal, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I don't know. People know, I don't know if people know how much work we actually put in trying to get ready for these shows, because I know it sounds sometimes like we don't have the slightest idea what we're talking about, which is also true. But sometimes we've actually read all the books and done studying before we come up. And I think that's what has been fun for me is doing the show, is getting the prep has been, I've read stuff I never would have read otherwise. It's been fun working with you, because you've got also a winning personality for a Southern gentleman, and and we've had a lot of fun with this, so it's been great. Let's do another 10. Let's see, I'll be about 100 then. So,
and it's interesting, when I was looking back on the show, we've had some regulars here who've been on more than a couple of times. We had B.J. Armstrong, Brian McGrath. I know I'm missing a couple, so I apologize if I'm missing anybody. Jerry Hendricks, Claude Barabé, Dimitri Gordon. We got to get Dimitri on again. James Holmes, Toshi Yoshihara. We've had pairs and separate, so we could gang up on their substantial intellect. We've had some really great guys. Mark Vandroff, of course, we've had on, who we probably should have on more as well. It's the amount of people out there that both are, whether they're on active duty, retired, work in industry, think tanks, or some of the up-and-coming people that we've had as well, Hunter Stiers, Allie Crawford. There are some young men and women out there who have great minds, and through hard study and I think a little bit of intuitive feel, that our nation and our allies have some great minds going forward to help us kind of get our head around what we need to do to secure what liberties the West has had. And I think that's just been a great honor that we've had, that people, some surprising people from Rumsfeld to the acting Secretary of Navy, Mobley, Admiral Moran, and others who have come on and have decided to spend some time with us and our listeners. It's been a great pleasure. And to be direct about it, very surprised, and in a good way.
Yeah, I think the other, I mean, we not only have had people been looking forward, but also we've been, I think the history that we've put on the show, you know, James Hornfisher in his books, Laura Hildenbrandt with her book, you know, about, I forgot the name of the book now, but anyway, you know, we've had some really good authors and a lot of the history stuff, which I think makes a difference. You can't really understand the future without knowing a lot about the past. And I think that the number of naval historians we've had on, you know, BJ Armstrong and Claude and folks like that have really helped shape our discussions about where should we go from here. I mean, why is the Navy important? You know, what are the best aspects of Navy? I think like BJ's recent book about small boats that's a very topical subject right now, very, very much in play. So I think that's been good. Yeah, Unbreakable. Thank you, Paul. Paul Whittington joined in with the name of the book because I'm an old guy and my memory slips every now and then. So yeah, I think that's been really good. And I think that some of our young people, like Jimmy Drennan and that show that we did with the thinking out of the box sort of thing, I think that was a really interesting show and a lot of fun. So as long as it's fun, we'll just keep doing it.
You're right. It is fun. And I think, you know, both of us, like a lot of the listeners, we have not just an interest, but a passion about our Navy and our sister services. And, you know, even though time perhaps takes its toll more on others, it's an opportunity in any small way to contribute. And I wanted to throw a little bit of love our way to our guests too, because regular listeners probably know it intuitively, but others may not. It takes a lot for well-known authors to our politicians that we've had, you know, Representative Banks and others who have come on, media types like Chris Cavas, David Larder, Phil Ewing. When these people who are high profile in their full-time job and profession, when they come on here, including the general officers and flag officers we had on board here, they come on not knowing what we're going to ask them. One thing we don't do here, we don't send people questions ahead of time. The most we'll do with a guest is during the pre-show, I'll say, hey, here's my opening scene setter question, just chew on it a little bit. But everything else is on the hip. It's a back and forth conversation. And we have had, we've no reason to mention their names, but we've had a few people we've wanted to bring on here who would only come on if they knew what questions we were going to ask them. So when people look at the list of guests that we've had over the years, be easy to those folks, because they're willing to come on with two people they really don't know. We're not in a studio together. You know, you and I are located 7 to 8 hours driving up the East Coast from each other. And we've had people come in from the Horn of Africa, Germany. How far across the Pacific have we gone? I think maybe Guam. I could be wrong there. But all over the place have come in, usually live. We have done a few pre-records because it's hard to ask somebody in Djibouti to come on at 4 o'clock in the morning, or Germany at 1 o'clock in the morning on a school night. But I have been very impressed with some of the individuals who said, yeah, I'll come on and talk live with folks. I think that says a lot for them.
Yeah, and I think the time commitment too. I mean, we've only had a few guests who had to rush off because they were extremely busy on something else. But, you know, the fact that we sit down for an hour, there is no There are no commercial breaks. It's you know, and a lot of, I think a lot of the folks we talk to like it. I like the format, and you know, we don't try to be controversial. We're not trying to stir up hornet's nests to get our own names out. You know, the famous, this is a really hard question. We want to know what the people we have on as guests have to say, and try and ask the questions we think the people who are listening would like to ask. So you know, it's, I think that helps us because we're not unfriendly or we're not taking sides for the most part. So I think that that opens up a lot.
It is. I would say one thing when you look at some of the feedback that we've received about the show. I know that the only real negative comment people make is our audio. Is it NPR quality? And that's true. And sometimes we've had some very rough items where one or both of us are calling in from the great American fruited plain with bad connections. And because of the location, at least that I'm at in, there's probably a little bit of echo coming off the walls. But that's because we don't have sponsors. We don't have expensive gear. Many times all we have is a cell phone and a parking lot at a truck stop. And it's also nice that a lot of our long-term listeners have accepted the fact that that's part of our show. It is kind of homegrown to a certain extent, but I think also people can appreciate that when we do have a topic or we do have a question that we bring up, it's not because we have a sponsor that's asked us to, or we've avoided certain topics. Though I think one thing that the good Lord will let us go another decade that I unquestionably want to stick with, and I think you hit on it right there, is the long format where we give our guests lots of time to answer questions. Occasionally there's dead air, and we leave it there just because we're going to make sure our guests got through asking their questions. And it's non-conversational. We're not out here to make news or to make a buck or anything like that. Because a lot of our guests that we've invited on, we've seen on their venues where they only have a 6-minute time slot. And you look at these folks and you go, man, I'd love to ask them this question and just let them go. And I won't use any names, but I think we all know who they are. We have some of our guests who are professors at various locations, and you can always tell because they do like to talk, which is good because it makes our job a little easier. I think if we, in the course of an hour, we only ask 4 or 5 questions.
Yeah, I think we've only had one guest that I recall who was just, it was like pulling teeth to try and get an answer or anything. And, you know, that's not bad over 10 years. And, you know, we haven't had, this is show, 522 or something. I don't think we've actually had live 522 shows, but, you know, let's say it's been 450 or something. Well, you know, that's a lot of shows.
Yeah.
And I think that having only one guest that we went, and this is hard work for us, is pretty good over that time. Most of the guests have been really good about responding to what we ask. And if we ask a dumb question, you know, they've been very kind and helped us understand the background of the answer they're going to give, and then give a really good answer that explains why we were foolish in asking the question the way we did, which is great.
It is. And that's one thing that our listeners who've also been guests know, we had ahead of time that it was nice because a lot of these guys are from DC and they understand, because I know your questions are perfectly structured and can be diagram a whiteboard, but occasionally I'll start asking a question and halfway through it, I'm going, I'm monologuing and making no sense. I'm going to shut up now and we'll see what they say. and God bless the fact that we pick good guests that are willing to roll with the punches. One thing I did, and anybody can do this, if you go to our live shows, at least always go up on Blog Talk Radio, then because of some stuff they did, we shift them over to Spreaker, which is what drives our podcast to iTunes and all the aggregators. But if you go over to Blog Talk Radio and you go back to page 49, you can actually get to the first year of our show that we did back in 2010. And I just looked at the first dozen shows, and they were about, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, what we were thinking about 10 years ago and what's happened. Look at the intro, which is kind of what we're doing right now, just talking around. Then we hit piracy. We talked about the growing multipolar world, Grand Naval Strategy. We talked about the QDR. We talked about the media ecosystem, something everybody takes for granted now, but at time. We had a very good show, I thought, on Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. We hit piracy again. We talked about control, which has been called, I think, three or four different buzzwords since then. Then we had one of the titans, Norman Friedman, on, who we've had a couple times. It was the first time we talked about China and the U.S. Marine Corps. So when I looked at that list, I remember back in 2010, especially you covered this a lot, piracy was big.
Yeah, and it's still around. There's still people out there. It's changed slightly. The seizure of ships like off Somalia has more or less stopped. Now the routine is to go on and grab a few, and like in the Gulf of Guinea, they grab a few crew members and hold them for ransom.
Yeah, I don't think it's gone anywhere. And if anything, I think the piracy off of Africa, whether East Coast or West Coast, it's going to be, you look at the economics and the demographics of that area, it's going to keep going.
Yeah, we're seeing a small increases right now in the Caribbean with the failing state of Venezuela. People are desperate for money. We've got we got all the great stuff. We got drug submarines still running, and you know, we got the Coasties and the LCSs out chasing these folks. So the pirates are, you know, they're still boarding ships. And a lot of them are sea robbers. They get on board the ship and they just try and steal something and get off the ship. And we had Daniel Sekulich, remember him? Because he actually went out with those guys in the Strait of Singapore or Strait of Malacca and rode with some pirates. Now that's a pretty bold move. But you know, that's going to go on. It's probably going on forever. Now we've got the Abu Sayyaf people in the Philippines, and they're kidnapping folks off ships and stuff. So it's an ongoing problem, and it has lessened quite a bit over the years. And, you know, a lot of that is due to the efforts of people like RECAP, the regional control organization down in the Strait of Malacca, with the countries all joining together to kind of fight piracy. And that's been a pretty successful program. And, you know, they just can't get their act together off the coast of Africa yet. But, you know, there's still time.
Yeah, lots of time. And before we get too far along the lines, I did promise the listeners we'd have a surprise guest, though once we get him on board, he's not going to be too much of a surprise. But we're not through patting her on back yet, I don't think. And what I wanted to do, because is I wanted to bring on as a guest somebody that a few people know the story of the origin story of Midrats, not quite a superhero origin story, but I still think it's kind of interesting. And I want to make sure we talked about Raymond, but there's another individual I want to bring on that was kind of the Midrats midwife. And we're going to give him a call. And let's see if he picks up. So here we go.
One ringy dingy.
Hey. Hello.
Hey, Claude. Good afternoon. Welcome to Midrats. We have you on live. How you doing?
Good. How are you? And congratulations on 10 years, guys. I think it's absolutely fantastic what you've done for everybody in the Navy and national security community.
Well, thank you very much, Claude. And you are my surprise guest, our surprise guest. And the reason I wanted to bring you on is even before Midrats existed, back in the day, even though you weren't a blogger yourself, you had an interest in the non-traditional areas of discussion about maritime security, naval issues, national security. I know that in addition to my co-host and I, you read and communicated with other of the original tranche. And one of the reasons I give you full credit for Midrats being here, and if my wife ever gets mad at me for doing the show, I'll say, well, let's pause. But when I left active duty in 09, one of the things that I looked at when I was home, mostly because I was unemployed, I was looking at doing what was then a strange thing called a podcast on my own, but I just couldn't quite kind of get my head around wanting to do it, when I was going to do it. And then you came out and you got in touch with Eagle One, the illustrious Galarin, and myself, and were the catalyst to get us together and to get us out there in the discussion marketplace. I want to, because you were somebody who was thinking about the value, and now we have this extensive ecosystem, and there's a great cornucopia of choices that people have to listen to podcasts. And they weren't that common back then, but talk a little bit about the value you saw in this medium in the national security arena, and what you've seen, not just at a distance, viewing from a distance, but also as a participator, because you've been a guest here, and I'll mm-hmm. give you a chance to pimp the Naval Academy Museum's Preble podcast that you started here in the last couple of months. But give us your view on the medium itself and what it's become, and plus or minus the value you think that it brings to the conversation.
Sure. I think it grew out of a couple of things. First, you and I, and I'd spoken to a couple of other bloggers as well for an article I wrote. It probably came out in 2009, I guess. It was called, I can't even remember the darn title of it now, but Creative Friction Without Conflict. And it was about the PBS series Carrier and how I thought it was a great idea about these bloggers that were writing about naval issues. I thought it was great when some of the PAOs that I spoke with didn't think it was so great, that all this analysis and commentary was being put out there. The second part of that was because I've been in the D.C. area for a while now, there was a radio show called Sports Junkies. It's still around, I think. And it was these four guys in their 20s who just like to talk about sports. And I thought, geez, why can't the Navy have something like that? So I think that's when I spoke with you and Galarin and Eagle One and someone else. And so I think you and I were thinking about the same thing, and it really seemed to achieve some sort of critical mass of ideas at that point, which I thought was great. But what I think you guys have brought to the table is Midrats is informative. Because you guys allow people to answer the questions for 1 minute or 10 minutes. It's informal. And, I've been on, I don't know, with you guys, maybe once a year or something. And I always feel like I'm sitting on the front porch with you guys, sipping a mint julep, chatting about whatever's going on. And I think that's really refreshing in an era where people have become so accustomed to cable news and just people shouting at each other that nobody's getting anything substantive across, and you can't really get a question out. And what I have loved about listening to Midrats is that you guys provide that. It's good natured. As Eagle One mentioned earlier, you never play gotcha. And, we've worked together over the years and in getting some guests on. And whenever somebody asks me about this, that's the first thing I say, is they're not out to get you. They're out for information so people can be informed. And I think that's the greatest service that you guys have been able to provide in a format that doesn't really exist anywhere, or at least didn't exist for many years. It's not self-promotional. You're not part of an organization that pays your way or that you have to get ads for. So you're free to talk about any subject. You're not restricted in the questions you ask. Nobody's ever going to question your motives. And it's just a great sit down for an hour every Sunday. And I think that's those are some of the things that you guys have brought to the table and that I think we're all grateful for, not only speaking as somebody who's one of the many people you've interviewed, but as one of your many listeners.
Wow. Yeah, thanks. I think without your and Galron and some other folks kind of saying, you know, this would be a really good idea. And we did have some growing pains. We tried to figure out how to do it with three moderators. And then, you know, I think the two, Galron had to go for other reasons, but I think it was, you know, getting down to just two people asking the questions has really worked out mm-hmm. well for us. And I there's so many other good naval podcasts. And the thing is, we're not in competition with them. That's the other
right.
thing. So if I recommend, you know, your podcast or Ward Carroll and the USNI podcast, I mean, those are really good things for people to listen to too. And there's no, you know, there's, I know everybody only has a few hours in a day to do this stuff, but you know, if you're out driving or you're jogging or whatever, picking up one of those and just listening to it as you're going around the block or whatever, it's just is a great way to pass some time and learn something new.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, I think it's I take my cue from what Commander Salamander told me early last year. I guess I don't know, Sal, was it about, I might have still been on deployment or something. It might have been like February or March, and I was telling you about this idea I had that I'd like to do for the museum on a naval history podcast. And I certainly didn't want to, you know, jump in your sandbox because I know you guys have done a lot of naval history. But it was just something that I didn't want to do current affairs. I just wanted to do stuff that, you know, interview naval historians, rising and experienced historians. And Sal, I got to tell you, I want to thank you publicly for that support. I wouldn't have done the podcast when I asked you the question if you had said, yeah, you know, I don't feel comfortable about it. But you were just a perfect gentleman, and you were completely supportive of the idea. And it just took me, I guess, about 6-7 months to finally get going. But thank you very much for that.
I'm glad to. I'll wax your apple a little bit, Claude. You know, you're one of my favorite people, but you really are, because you've heard me use the phrase the marketplace of ideas, and you. Mm-hmm. Let's see, how can I phrase this without triggering anybody? I don't know. I'll just roll with it anyway. There are people out there who are in it for other reasons besides, you know, let the best ideas win. They have other agendas, other angles. Mm-hmm. They're not willing to play on a level playing field, things like that manner. And you always have been. You and I've behind your back, I've talked to former students of yours. And people who have run into you professionally. And you, just like you did with us to start Midraps, you're all very supportive. You don't have to be in full alignment or full agreement with somebody. As if you feel that they're, you know, well-meaning people that are willing to go out there and exchange ideas and add to the conversation, that you're going to support them, if need be, and be an ear occasionally. So a lot of people may not realize that because we don't talk about it enough, but you know, you mentioned Ward Carroll and the USNI podcast. Those guys, the SimSec Sea Control podcast, we also have Salty Herald. These are ones that have had us on as guests on their podcast show. And there is a lot of very reasoned, positive thinking people in what can be, because it's a serious subject area. It can be very competitive in some areas, but there mm-hmm. is a wedge of it that, and we all pretty much know each other and we communicate with each other, that hopefully adds more light than heat And on the margins, at least, because a lot of people have an interest, and if you only have one source or two sources, you may not be getting the full picture. And yep, there's a lot to choose from now, but hopefully that just increases the people's ability to get a better view of what's going on out there.
I think you're absolutely right. The more the merrier, and everybody's going to cut at things from different angles. And as you know, you pointed out to me back in 2009, that's a good thing. Because that's that creative friction that will eventually get to new ideas and different ideas.
That's perfect. Well, Claude, I appreciate you. Let me call you out of the blue and wax your apple a bit. And you're too much of a gentleman to do it, but I will say, folks, if you wish Midrats did more naval history than the other topics we pick out, well, you don't have to wait for us to do that. Look up Preble Hall. Claude has brought on some really, really sharp people as of late. It's definitely worth adding to your list. And Claude, we look forward to having you on a guest here at Midrats here this year sometime, talking about a particular topic as opposed to ourselves.
Thanks. And I wish you guys another great 10 years. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, and thanks for filling in for me when I was off hiking the little bits of the Appalachian Trail I was on. So you may get invited to do
My
that
pleasure.
Again here soon.
My pleasure. Take care, guys.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Claude. And we've already gone to the bottom of the hour. That's one thing, too. If there are any potential future listeners out there, not listeners, future guests out there, occasionally we'll have a guest comes on who they say, well, how long is the show? We go, an hour, and the line gets a little quiet, or they take a couple of days to reply to the email. An hour goes by very, very fast. And before I roll it your way here, Eagle One, during our regular intro, I mentioned that if you are so inclined to scroll down to the bottom of the show page and jump in the chat room with the usual suspects. And we've got some of the usual suspects there today that I'll just want to go ahead and mention here. Lee, who has actually been a guest here in the past, Paul Withington, Scott Brim, they're some of the usual suspects in the chat room. We have gotten some really good ideas and some really good questions just from the chat room. So we do appreciate those who do join us live and help us in the chat room. And on the topic of live, I know we promised our listeners after we got through Perini the first half of the hour, we would go over to some news of the day. So Eagle One, what's above the fold on your thought for today?
Well, I've been fascinated by the death of the Quds commander in Iraq and the astonishing reaction to it. I mean, there was a Texas kind of semi-outlaw, but he killed a lot of people in the name of good. And he says, and I think at the foot of his tomb, at his grave now, there's a sign that says, "Some people just need killing." And if there was ever a guy that needed killing, that the guy they just took out was one. And I'm sure that all these people were screaming about power, you know, the presidential powers and why it was done at this time and all that stuff, and national security memos and how it happened are, you know, going to go off the deep end as they usually do this time, every time anything happens like this. But I'm just amazed. I mean, here's a guy who has been responsible for the death of if not thousands, hundreds of U.S. troops and death and injury and Iraqis and Iranians and other folks. And, you know, some folks are acting like we've just taken out some high exalted monkey monk who was a peace loving guru sitting on top of a mountain.
Yeah. I've mentioned this to a couple of folks, SEPCOR, but there are people who really should know better who are reacting like this is a domestic political issue. It's not. I perfectly understand why previous administrations and this one had allowed Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, go and live. there is an always an ongoing calculus. What are the pluses and minuses? Have they crossed the line? In this line is different person for that person? Everything's a risk reward. But you and I are both old enough that we remember what happened the last time we had an embassy overrun. What happened when we had terrorists attack our embassies? And this guy and his buddies did that and failed in Baghdad. And at least from my perspective, that his life was forfeit at that point. You have to bring, I think Petraeus mentioned yesterday or the day before that, the day before yesterday, that this established, we established deterrence for some of these guys, that it doesn't matter who you are, that there are things you cannot do and expect to get away with. And plus, this guy had the audacity to tool around Baghdad International with his buddies. And I wasn't at the decision brief, and history will disclose to us what was discussed there. But it was time. It was time, and let the chips fall where they may internationally. But when you allow somebody like that to escalate what they're doing, and who knows how close our certain measures weren't taken, how that embassy would have been able to continue forward. But you've got eventually to put a marker down for other individuals. And if it has consequences here or there, fine, but those are probably less consequences than would have happened if you did nothing.
Well, and as I recall, this guy was also responsible for the Hezbollah attack on the Marine barracks back in 83. I mean, this is not some guy who just kind of showed up yesterday. He's been involved in this stuff for a long, long time. Some people just, as we said, some people just deserve to be whacked, and he's one of them. And you kind of move on. Now, I see the Iraqi parliament is going to throw all the Americans out of Iraq. I'm saying, yeah, throw us in that briar patch. If you want to be totally dominated by Iran, you go right ahead. But we'll let you know what the cost is going to be, because all that support that you had when the ISIS and all those people were charging around, well, guess what? That's going to go away. All that air support, all that stuff, unless you guys have your own indigenous stuff and it's really up to snuff, good luck with that. But if you want to remain an independent state, you better think twice about what you're going to do with us.
Yeah, and you hit on it right there. And I'll give credit to NPR. When I was trying to get good reporting on this, which is hard to get because everything's political in an election year, NPR did a really good report where they outlined the fact that almost all the Sunni and all the Kurds voted against it. There are some questions. This wasn't in the NPR report. This is in something I read before the show started. There's a question whether it even had a quorum. They have a caretaker prime minister who was on the way out because he was seen as a stooge of Iran. So, yeah, but if they want to throw us in that briar patch, okay. All right. We'll break my heart. Regulars here know my stance about garrisoning the planet. So it is what it is. But I think in the end, like you said, some people just need a good killing. And this guy did so. Let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, and Iran wants to, now is in the position, if they want to retaliate, they know that we're not going to sit idly by, if we're going to play tit for tat, we've got more tat than they have. So it's going to be it may be ugly, and I see people in the chat room concerned about the Iranian submarines and surface to surface missile threats and all this. All this stuff has always been there. And if Iran wants to shut the Strait of Hormuz, we've always known they could do that. And who does that hurt the most? Because they don't have a lot of oil pipelines going to China and some of their other best customers. So you know, if they want to shoot themselves in the foot some more, I invite them to do so.
Yeah, nobody's asking advice, but and the comparison here is imperfect in a variety of ways. However, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is to the Iranian military what the Waffen-SS was to Nazi Germany. They're not that popular with the regular forces. They're just not. They're a political organization in addition to a combat organization. They kind of do their own thing. If the Iranians and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard want to do some stuff, we can do in return, just focused on them, that I think combined with ratcheting down further economic pressure on the country, we can do more for them than they can do to us. And yeah, there have been rumors for years about they have sleeper cells all over the place waiting to be activated. Well, if they're going to be activated this week, then, you know, they'll be activated this week. They would have been activated another month, another 6 years. But eventually, free nations have to stop letting themselves be blackballed by evil third-rate powers. And that's what Iran is. And if the Iranian Navy wants to create some trouble in the Gulf, that will spike global oil prices, well, so be it. That is what history will bring. But they're not going to last very long. The best thing the Iranian Navy and the Iranian regular army can do is stay put, stay in their garrisons, and don't bother us. If the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and their Navy want to do some stuff, best thing we could do is leave the regular Iranian Navy alone, leave the regular Iranian army alone, as long as they're leaving us alone, and just do some urban and island renewal everywhere there is an Iranian Revolutionary Guard base. Just a thought.
Yeah, no, I you know, we've been through this a number of times. I just am always amused at the, you know, the lesson of we talked to General the Marine Corps general
Ben Riper?
About that. Yeah, Ben Riper, about the war game and the use of small boats. You know, that was an eye opener. That's great, but the small boat threat in face of things like AC-130 gunships and stuff like that. You know, you can, yeah, it's an issue, but it's a control. I think it's a controllable issue, and we're alert. You know, we should be alert. Now, that doesn't always mean we are alert to the fact that that threat exists, you know, with air power and stuff, you can control a lot of that stuff. And, you know, it looks good on TV cameras to have 400 little boats come charging across the Arabian Gulf. But, you know, in reality, that's like sending your cavalry on horses into a brigade of machine gunners. I mean, it's just not the smartest thing in the world you could do. No, and I may be overly optimistic about our ability to respond to that, but I don't think I'm too far off.
No, I think it's one of those things that, you know, history will show us one way or another, but things would have to really turn interesting ways. And I would like to see that an ongoing argument of why this guy should have been allowed to continue doing what he was doing. And he was getting more and more brazen. And we'll see. The thing I've always concerned about, and we talked about it when I was there, but what will Iran do or not do in Afghanistan as a result? The only advantage we have there is the only appreciable population of Shia are the Hazara, who are not only ethnic minorities but also religious minorities, and they owe a lot to the Iranians. But it would take a lot for the Iranians to want to have the Hazara come after us, because the Hazara are more concerned with the Pashtun than anybody else. But they, the Afghan theater has always been a little bit of a different relationship with the Iranians than we have with the Iranians on the other side of their country. We've actually cooperated and tolerated each other quite well, I think, because from the beginning, we've recognized the Imperial League, that Afghanistan historically is inside the Iranian sphere of influence. And as much as we can, we've respected that. But I'm kind of looking to see if anything happens with the Hazara in Afghanistan. But I think that's an extremely low probability because they've got other things to worry about besides us.
And, you know, and it goes back to what you said earlier. A lot of these places we've overstayed our welcome. You know, and that's a nice thing. If the thinking is on Iran, and I think, you know, we don't need to invade Iran and set up a government and all that stuff, you know, but that place is ripe for punitive expeditions. And, you know, their forces, you know, somebody was talking about their F-14s and how great they were. Well, the F-14 is great, but, you know, there are countermeasures to everything, and I think we've got those things. So it's just time. You know, we also have to look forward to what's going on with China and what the Russians are doing. And the Russians are just, you know, they're just out making trouble. They're not a very powerful country, as it turns out. But the questions that we have are, can we get our, you know, I see again that the 355 for 352, whatever number of ships it's going to be, Navy's back in the news, and Lee is raising the issue of why is it taking it so long to upgun the LCSs, because it's really just a modular thing. We ought to be able to cut the hull and slap those suckers in there. Now, I'm not a ship architect, naval architect by any means, but, you know, we've done it on other ships. We did it to the Gearing class destroyers basically were just slightly larger hulls than the ones that preceded them. So I don't know how much difficulty there really is in that, or if we just, you know, are too busy trying to design everything to make it perfect. We don't need perfect. We need good enough, and we need to get it out there as soon as possible.
Yeah, I think part of the problem with LCS is because of the compromises that were made to get the speed, they are a little more exquisitely engineered when it comes to weight and riding arm and, you know, all the balance and everything that goes with that. You, especially on the Independence class, you have, you know, on the evens, you have some square footage and a great flight deck. But when it comes to adding weight and things like that, I don't think you're going to, you have much flexibility to upgun them. So much is just baked in there. I think the best demonstration of that is they've slapped some naval strike missiles on the bow and deployed them forward. There are a few things in the naval world besides a crane that is less stealthy than those welded to the deck launchers. So it's not like they're big ships, and now they have but like we saw with the Israeli ship Hanit, if you're going to be facing some old cruise missiles, they're going to focus in on your largest radar reader. In the Hanit, it was their crane they had on the stern. With LCS, I guess it's going to be right under the bridge, because that's where the NATO strike missiles are. Yeah, when you're looking, one thing that it's going to be fascinating to watch. You know, LCS was definitely the story of the last decade and a half. Now we've been talking about decommissioning the first four early, but I was looking at what I, tongue-in-cheek, had called for a while the terrible 20s. But, I mean, I look forward to the next decade. We've got a lot of X programs that simply have to flesh out. And God bless the acting Secretary of the Navy, Mobley. He's doing all he can to beat the 355 drum. But I don't know how we get that, but also make sure we have the funding to get a new warship, their replacement for the Arleigh Burke, something perhaps for they could be the equivalent of our cruisers that are extremely long in the tooth. We've got the replacement for the FA-18, and I know that the people who live in comic book land want to make everything drones, but this isn't the decade to make that bet. I think we'll hear pretty soon about the FFGX, which I hope will be the Frem, and we're going to be going through the birthing pains for the Columbia class submarine. All those things, and we haven't even touched on making the Ford work. I don't know where that money is coming from. It's all money. You can talk all day long, but do you have a bag of gold that you could throw in the kitty there?
Yeah, I'm sure that we could cut some really useful program that we know is wasting billions of dollars. You know, because it's like every year they do the audit and they go, well, the food stamp program, you know, they can't account for X billion dollars. And you're going, well, how does that work? How do we not know where all this money is going? You know, and then they say, well, the Pentagon has never been audited. Of course, we just went through the audit or gone in the process of auditing the Pentagon. But, you know, there's so many other programs that waste so much money, and it just, they count it as, well, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon it adds up to real money. But, you know, when a ship costs $1 billion, not having $20 billion that you should have because you went to fraud, waste, and abuse, or wherever, somewhere else in the government, you know, we don't have to have a budget increase. We just need to make sure we know where all the money's going. And you know, that's the frustrating part to me is it always says, well, the Pentagon is wasting all this money. The Pentagon wastes money, yes, but we don't even come close to some of these other programs who produce nothing. They give money to people. How hard should that be? You know, I mean, it can't be that tough to keep track of who you're giving money to and how much they're getting, and cracking down on these people who are scamming the system. But that's just a hobby horse I like to ride.
Yeah, it will be riding that until we all get called home, so to speak. But
you kids stay off my lawn.
You kids, I think that's one of the fascinating things is that we've seen in the last 10 years too, is in spite of the fact having arguably the best economy that we've seen in our lifetimes, the amount of debt that we're taking on board. I don't know when that music stops, but there aren't enough chairs for everybody to take a seat. I don't know how that's going to work itself out. We have a huge defense budget, and I know we have our biases, but you know, geography speaks pretty well, the fact that we're a naval and an aerospace power. But when you've got former Secretary of the Army as SecDef, when you have Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is an Army guy, and because of Fat Leonard, we lost directly or indirectly, you know, half of an entire generation of senior naval leaders. We've got good ones there, but that was a lot of capital inside the Beltway that's flushed away. I don't see how we are going to win that argument for money at the end of the day. And I know, you know, Brian McGrath has been really good at making that argument that we just need to get the money. And I agree with him. And the money's there. I agree with him. But who's going to put that funding line? Who's going to make that argument? I'm still looking for him. I'd love to have somebody out there who can do it in Congress. But at least in this election year, I don't see it breaking above the ambient noise.
Well, when you promise everything to everybody, everything's going to be free. You're going to have free college. You're going to have free health care. You're going to have free this, free that. You know, that's the problem. Somebody, and I don't know who it's going to be, but somebody's got to go say, look, you know, there is no such thing as a free lunch. We all know that. And you know, somebody, if we're going to do all this stuff, somebody's taxes are going to have to go up. And we're going to have to cut down some programs and follow up on this fraud, waste, and abuse stuff. I mean, it's just, you know, I know every now and then we go through the great fraud, waste, and abuse witch hunt in the military, but trust me, I don't believe the military holds a candle to some of the fraud, waste, and abuse that goes on in some of these other programs.
Now, that's one thing I would like for our FBI to be more focused on is a lot of the fraud and the white collar criminals who are rent seeking, like you read about on government programs. This is more than two decades ago when I lived in California. The fraud involved with the medical government, Medi-Cal, and just off the hook. I don't think that's gotten any better. I don't think it's gotten anywhere better in a lot of the states too. But yeah, again, that takes a leader who's willing to make that fight, and I don't see that taking place. But eventually it will. When you run out of money, like the old cliche goes, then you have to start thinking. And when the market decides it no longer wants to lend us money for free, then we'll have to get smart. And like Paul just said in the chat room, no, I'm not a fan of modern monetary theory. It's kind of like having a kid walking around the house going, do you have any money you want? Oh yeah, sure. Here's a $20 bill. That's just modern monetary theory. This is not an economics blog, but there are some good ones out there. No, that when that music stops playing, there's going to be a lot of people not having a seat.
No. And that's, you know, judging by some of the candidates for office, I mean, I don't know where they think this stuff comes from, but since they all plan to take it from the top 1%, but, you know, I think we've seen a number of studies. You could take all the money that all the top 1% have, everything they own and more, and you wouldn't even come close to putting a dent in what these people are proposing. But, you know, I guess reality only works when they claim to be reality-based people, but I don't know where their reality is. It's a different reality than I live in.
Yeah, they live in an unquestionably different reality. And another different reality that I was going to think about topics for today, and I just realized how late it was getting. We talked a lot about Russia in the course of the last 10 years. Like, before everybody else will be Russian hipsters, we were talking about Russia here where nobody else was. But everybody likes to talk about Russia now. But I think what we're going to see is the last of the legacy big blue water navy of the Soviet Union is literally sinking in the dry docks. The decade that just ended is the last decade we're really going to see the Slavas, the Sovremenys, the Udaloys, the Kuznetsovs. They've got, I think, one Victor III left. The Akulas and the Sierras are really old, really old. The Russians are pushing out some quality stuff, but the numbers are going to be really small. And as we've covered here, they have some really good regional kit Corvettes that have lots of teeth for their size. But that'll be one thing that the we're going to watch in the course of the next decade, that locally and regionally, you'll see the Russian Navy, but they're big, impressive, nightmare-generating ships. They're not going to be around much longer.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm also curious as to how long the Chinese Navy can continue its growth and what kind of quality controls they have on their systems. And, you know, if they're going to be a regional power, and that seems to be what they're doing, although they've, you know, this Belt and Road and all these efforts to secure their sea lines of communication, you know, that is something we really need to keep an eye on. I know that these islands that they've kind of given money to and now are claiming that they have the right to harbor their, to port their naval vessels there and all that stuff, you know, that is an issue that is going to be continuing to erupt as over the next 10 years. And, but I do wonder about the quality of what the Chinese have. And, you know, what kind of maintenance programs they have and stuff like that. It's going to be, I think that's an interesting thing. It looks nice and shiny right now, and they certainly can throw a lot of bodies at what they do for maintenance. But I'm just curious as to whether their systems are up to the first, you know, the standards that we would have for our own vessels. Of course, lately I'm not sure how good those standards are either. So.
Well, we have a couple of assumptions without going into details. We have a couple of assumptions about our cutting edge equipment that we think we've had for a long time that performs real well, that more testing is required. For those that know the history of torpedoes prior to World War II, I think we have that in some systems, and I'll guarantee you the Chinese have it in spades, because one thing the Chinese culture doesn't have, that we at least aspire to have, is an honest test and evaluation system where if something sucks, we try to fix it. Now, things do slip in and reality force you to change. I think perfect example is in ProPublica, you got to give them credit. They've done some great reporting on this in the last month, that some genius out there decided that real-world naval warships needed to look like Star Trek The Next Generation or the Star Trek movies consoles, and we're having touch screens and plasma displays, which if anybody knows their naval warfare, knows how shocking actual combat can be, they realized that not only were they not very robust, that they're hard to operate. You have three windows hiding two windows, it's giving you alert. So they're going back to manual controls, which I think is smart. But there are some Chinese systems, and I had my old security clearance and I could go behind the cipher door and Paycom's N2 shop, that I'm sure somebody out there has access to Chinese test and evaluation open systems and knows, you know, what percentage they are of our systems. But I think you're right. They've got some beautiful ships. They're producing a lot of them. Their human capital strategy is probably interesting to see. But ultimately, how many of those kinks do they have worked out where they can go shoot, to the point they're Winchester and have a decent ability to engage the targets we or our friends might throw at them? I don't know. And if history shows us anything, many times you've got to go into combat to really figure that out. So hopefully the Chinese won't figure that out in the next decade.
Yeah, and that is my fervent wish. But we also need to, I mean, we've got our own issues. We, as you've already said, I mean, the not only with simple things like the LCS, which is, you know, that's not a complex ship. Fundamentally, it is very electronic driven though. And, but things like the F-35, I mean, I'm not, and I should also say, you know, we need to look at our personnel issues, and we really need to think more about what is good for our force. So, I don't know how, what kind of feedback you get, but I get occasional rumblings that some of the bases we have are so poorly located that people don't want to live there, you know, that for a variety of reasons, they're afraid for their families because of the environmental conditions of the bases. And you know, what employer who mandates you have to live in some remote location in the world, doesn't go, well, you know, we're going to make everything as nice as we can for you. And if, you know, we'll even let you, you know, work remotely if you have to, but, you know, let's get this base someplace where the air is clean and the water's pure and all the people are, all the schools are above average and all the kids can be above average. So, you know, whereas some of the bases are, that is not the reputation they have. And we've had good bases that we let get away.
Yeah, we've talked about that. That goes back to the green eyeshade folks at Barack. And I will argue this till I'm blue in the face. One of the worst decisions we ever made was to go for master bases. which are huge bases where quality of life, the quality of work is impacted, because when everybody starts going home, you just sit in traffic. The rest of the city is doing great, but coming out of the base, it becomes a nightmare. Everything is, I've been stationed on small, medium, and large bases, and your quality of work and quality of life has always been inversely proportional to the size of the base, in my experience. And you're right, we lost something when we became so focused on efficiency that we completely abandoned entire sectors of our republic. We abandoned some incredible square footage, and we abandoned the ability for people that are from, I don't know, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Burlington, Vermont, Boston, Massachusetts, to serve their country and also be within an afternoon's drive of their family. And I don't know how we ever get any of that back. I just hope that we don't make it worse at any point down the road. It is an underappreciated topic.
Yeah, well, I know it's driving some junior officers out of the Navy. I mean, if they, and I'll use the example of California. You know, we've taken military bases in California. We've closed the ones that were visible to the public, and we're making noise. Let's say over lovely San Diego. I mean, you know, Miramar is still there as a Marine base. I'm just flabbergasted why we're not using it as a Navy base. But you know, then you put you relocate bases to the middle of a valley where nobody knows they're there, and it's I used to live in that valley. It's an unpleasant environment a lot of times during the year, and you know, what good does that do for your retention if you are out in this spot in the middle of no place when there were other options available and probably better options available, even if you had to locate the base you know, another 150 miles to the east and put it in Nevada someplace. I mean, I just don't understand the logic of where we put some of our facilities and why we leave them there. And, you know, is it tied purely to some congressional thing that happened, you know, 20 years ago, or is it just stubbornness that now we have this thing, we're not going to give it up. And, you know, we don't care what happens to our people. They're replaceable.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think for people who think with green eye shades, they see people as objects and numbers, not as individuals. I know there are a lot of officers and enlisted folks who have spouses who are professionals and who have spent years of education and developing professional reputations. And they, if you get stationed in some of these places, they can't work. They can't do it. And you're asking a lot of people to, if I hear one more three-time divorced GOFO with no children say, well, you can geobatch it for a couple of years, I'll lose my mind. One of the saddest things I used to see is a Southwest flight that would go from Norfolk to Jacksonville. Geobachelors, tons of them. And there are other flights between various locations you'll see. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that people are in good schools, don't want to go to bad schools. But another part of it is, you know, my spouse is a doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, and they can't go where I'm going because they can't be a doctor, lawyer, or Indian chief. You know, as most listeners know, my lovely and gracious wife is an attorney. And if she had to take one more bar exam, she would be my ex-wife. So instead of that, I'm former Navy. So that's something that is also underappreciated. And I think we've all seen them as well, where you will have people you work for who are, I want to use his name, but I won't. Most listeners here will know exactly what I'm talking about. People who didn't get married until they made flag officer, and they expect everybody who works for him to work 6.5 days a week and to be available 24/7, 365. When you have those types of climates, you lose good people. The best officers of my year group, who should be a flag officer right now, didn't screen for command because he said no to somebody because he needed to stay in place. And he had a good job for 2 years because his daughter was born with a condition that means she wouldn't live to age 5. And, he was punished by a guy that had been working on his fourth wife. And that's, I don't know how we address that. And you and I have talked and had some guests here of senior leaders who get it. But that's going to be a long-term cultural fix. I think we have people in place where it might be trending in the right direction, but perhaps the slope isn't as fast as we really need it to be to address, like you said, losing good people.
Yeah, I just, and a lot of it, if someone would act like they cared, I would like to be more than an act, but if somebody would just say, look, we know this is a mess and we'd like to, and we're going to try and fix this, that would go a long way to people going feeling better. But, when it's the, if you don't like, I remember when I was contemplating getting out of the Navy. And this was during the Carter years. That's how long ago it was. But some assistant secretary of the Navy or defense or someplace came in, and people were asking him questions about, what was happening and some of the changes were being made in the service. Well, if you don't like it, vote with your feet was his answer. You're going, that really is the wrong answer. What other business would tell their employees, we spent a lot of money training you. You've got all this experience and what we've decided to do is just make things bad. And if you decide to leave, it's okay with us. We'll train somebody new. What a huge waste of money and time. And, that's just the wrong approach. Well, my opinion, of course, others may feel free to disagree. But all I know is that I don't know if anybody wants to be treated that way. That, you don't like the conditions here that I've just created, then too bad.
Yeah, that's the challenge. Well, Our loyal listeners are probably losing their patience with us. But here's something that I don't mention enough that I probably should. But, we started with the show and we talked about the fact, and this is a good thing, more voices are better. There are a lot of podcasts out there that talk about national security issues. Some that have been around as long as we have. But there are new people who are coming in to this area of interest every day, and they look for podcasts. And if you stuck with our 10th anniversary show this long, that means you're a fan of Midrats. If you haven't already, what I'd ask for are folks that have stuck with us this long, go over to iTunes or whatever aggregator you use, give us a 5-star review, and give us 2 or 3 sentences about what you like the show. What that does is when people search for podcasts like this, we'll come up higher in the search rankings and they'll give us a listen. And if they like us, they'll stay. If not, they'll go. But if you haven't done it already, I would just ask for the folks that are friends of the show, go over, preferably iTunes, because that drives a lot of it. Give us a 5-star ranking with 2 or 3 sentences, and that'll help other people find the show that will enjoy it as well as you do. And again, I'll kind of close as I started. It's been a great 10 years of partnership here. I hope that we've brought more light than heat, which I think we have. And however long we keep this going, I look forward to it. I appreciate it, not just you, but our guests and our regular listeners and the good folks in the chat room who are always throwing us some good ideas.
Yeah, I second everything you said, except that you've been great to work with, and I look forward to working with you for as long as we can do this.
Yes, sir, and thank you, everybody, for joining us for our 10th anniversary Midrats. Again, we appreciate everybody who's a listener here, and if you ever have things you'd like us to talk about, pop us an email. Until next time, here's to a great 2020. Cheers.
Piccadilly, or you'll be up to